Gesellschaft besser machen. In weniger als 30 Minuten. Der Körper-Kurz-Podcast. Die heutige Folge wird aufregend und aufwühlend zugleich. Es ist unsere erste Folge in englischer Sprache. Zu Gast ist Tricia Shetty, indische Anwältin, Aktivistin und Gründerin von She Says. Sie setzt sich für Gleichberechtigung ein. Zuletzt war sie Teil der Proteste gegen den Citizenship Amendment Act in Indien. Dieser macht eine Staatszugehörigkeit von der Religion abhängig und schließt dabei muslimische Menschen aus. Ich bin gespannt auf Ihre Einblicke in die Situation vor Ort und die inspirierenden Geschichten der Aktivistin. Und damit wechsle ich in die englische Sprache. Today with me is Tricia Shetty, all the way to India. Hello.
Hi, how are you?
Not too bad, you?
Not too bad. This is day 51 of our lockdown and it looks like it's going to extend maybe to another month. So yes.
Great, you mention it because we're still in the lockdown of the corona pandemic. So it's going to be an interview over Zoom and over the phone. And it's very interesting because many people probably are so focused on their own country that they keep forgetting that other countries have special situations at the moment. Mm-hmm. And to start off, I'd be very curious to hear how is the situation in India, not only in terms of the pandemic, but also in terms of the general protest that you belong. So maybe you want to introduce the Citizenship Amendment Act.
Just to give context, this was happening before the coronavirus pandemic pretty much put all global and national, you know, activities to a halt. The Indian government had put forward a Citizenship Amendment Act, as well as proposed a National Registry of Citizens and a National NPR, a National Populations Registry, which in extension would be exclusionary towards our Muslim population. So they cited it as something that would be giving citizenship to those who have been in India before 2014 to our Bangladeshi, Pakistani, Afghani neighbors. But only giving asylum and rather citizenship to every other religion but those who don't identify as Muslim. So basically, unless you're Muslim, you could get citizenship if you belong to the four neighboring countries. But if you are not, you wouldn't. And, you know, the excuses they gave were this is because, you know, India is the land of, you know, where every Hindu should be able to seek asylum, and that there's a lot of religious prosecution in these places, you know, in Afghanistan against Hindus. But then let's not forget the Tamilians in Sri Lanka who are facing religious prosecution. Let's not forget the Ahmadi Muslims in Pakistan who face religious prosecution. You know, how do we forget the Uyghur Muslims in China who face religious prosecution? What about those that, you know, are atheists? What about those that belong to the LGBTQI community? So for the first time ever, citizenship was going to be given on the basis of religion. And that's not what is the fundamental backbone of our country. Our democracy promises us equality and secularism.
So isn't that the first time ever that citizenship was given on the based of religious belief?
Would be, yes. So what they didn't expect is the kind of pushback and the kind of mobilization that happened. So whilst students were protesting, students were subject to grotesque violence, state-sanctioned violence. We saw videos of police standing by passively whilst others with arms and sticks were going around assaulting, beating students. Mm. One lost his eye, which led to, you know, just anger and outrage. And people took to the streets to protest against this violence. And there was a beautiful thing that happened. Mothers and grandmothers took to the streets. And there was a indefinite sit-in that started called Shaheen Bagh. Shaheen Bagh sit-in in Delhi, which pretty much led to nationwide 24/7 indefinite sit-ins being led by women, mostly, you know, Muslim women, old women. And this was, let's not forget, a group of people that our government has been so quick to call, oh, the oppressed class, you know, the class that we need to uplift because their community is not doing enough. And here for the first time, you saw Muslim women in numbers, in huge numbers, mobilized, self-organized. And peacefully exercise their fundamental right to protest.
Now we have the lockdown. As it is so emotional and as so many things were moving and so many people were activated, what happened with this lockdown? Where are we standing today?
So the Shaheen Bagh protest went on for 101 days before they were vacated, becoming the longest protest against CAA. What happened is one day our prime minister comes on national television and says in 4 hours there's a nationwide lockdown. We're stopping all transport. We're stopping everything. You can't step out of your house anymore in the next 4 hours. A few days before that, he told us we need to show solidarity to our frontline heroes. And he gave us like, I think a 2-day heads up to come outside our windows at a specific hour and clap. Right? So we had a 2-day heads up to show solidarity to our frontline warriors and come outside our window and clap. But when it came to the nationwide lockdown, we got a 4-hour heads up. He showed up in the evening and said, after 11 p.m., there's a nationwide lockdown. And you can imagine.
Pretty shocking.
I mean, it's unacceptable. We had millions of daily wage migrant workers who ended up walking back home. Some walked for 100 miles. People died on their way whilst they were walking back to their villages because these are daily wage earners. They had no means of transport to go back. People stopped paying their money, obviously. Where would they live? And, you know, these are people who live lives of dignity. You are stripping people away, not just of their human rights, but also of their dignity. You talk about improving lives. And I think here in India, it's been a true conundrum where certain sections of society are having conversations about their mental health and how their mental health is getting destroyed because they're forced to be in lockdown. And certain sections of society are talking about rethinking home structures, rethinking partner relationships. What is the man of the household going to do? What is the woman of the household going to do? How can they improve their lockdown lives? And there's a huge section of society that just has everything that they hold dear to them on their backs, their children, and are just trying to get back home with no surety, no food, no money, just wanting to know when this will end. So lockdown, I think social isolation has been a privilege for us who can afford to have it.
Yeah.
But the state has, and sorry, the center has failed its poor drastically. This is not a government for the poor.
Obviously, this has been very emotional for you as well. And I wonder, are you not afraid when you go into these situations? How do you live day by day with being a social activist, having to deal with these issues that we thought were over?
I think it's a wonderful thing if you contrast, right? Like in Germany, in France, if anything, like protest is so much so integral as part of their culture. I always say this. Yeah. I say that protesting in the global north countries is woke. You're deemed to be socially aware, conscientious, an active citizen if you're protesting, like you dissent. Whereas here, if you protest, you get called an anti-national, you get called liptard, you get called a prostitute. Press gets called prostitute. You get called secular for being secular. You get called a terrorist, a terrorist sympathizer. You know, I have been told things like go suck Muslim genitalia, you know, as though that's an insult. But, you know, that's how depraved the thinking has become. And let's be very clear, it's become such a hostile environment for intellectuals, for activists, for lawyers, for human rights defenders, because it's been sanctioned by the highest offices.
Yeah.
Because there is an environment of fear that has been actively bred to keep its citizens, quote unquote, at check. There is social media propaganda that's run against you. There will be character assassination if you're a woman, trying to, you know, reduce you down to your sex. Nowadays, you know, you get detained, you get arrested, you get assaulted. I was assaulted by police personnel. You don't really think you would be treated as a criminal in your own country when you would hope the whole world is watching over. But you are. So is it safe? It's not safe. But I still have a Hindu sounding name. I'm still Hindu. So however bad it gets for me, it's 100 times worse for those who identify as Muslim in my country. You know, right now during COVID, physically I am safe. No one's going to come arrest me right now that I'm aware of. There may be, you know, you never know. That's what's happened now. But as we speak, there is a 27-year-old student called Safura Zargar, who is a student who was protesting against CAA. She's in her second trimester of pregnancy, and she has been charged under the UAP Act, which is the Unlawful Activities Prevention Act, which basically is used to designate people as terrorists. So she has been linked to the Delhi violence, charged under this act, and has been kept in solitary confinement during COVID. And they have charged a few other people under this act, and no surprises, all the people that have been charged identify as Muslim. So, you know, it's very telling of a government that continues to penalize, criminalize our Muslim community, that continues to penalize, criminalize those who dare to stand up in solidarity and dissent against fascism. And here, I think it's so critical for the world to demand for better. Is there no value for brown lives? Is there no value for the world's largest democracy? Because what happens here will have a cataclysmic effect everywhere. I think people's attention, especially when it comes to governance, starts and stops with what's happening with the world's oldest democracy, America. But it's prudent to remember that India was the one that first fell to nationalist populist rhetoric, even before Trump's nationalism was mainstream. If the world does not pay attention, if the world does not demand for better, you can forget. I mean, we're already realizing we're not really living in a democracy. It's a mirage of a democracy, but we're still holding on to it. So here, we definitely expect the world, the community, to demand for better from our government.
Absolutely. I mean, we see a re-nationalization and the my country first behavior. That's a serious obstacle to successful and sustainable international cooperation. So how can citizens contribute to an international cooperation, and how can we connect across national borders? What do you think?
You know, Pascal Lamy, the head of Paris Peace Forum and the ex-director general of the World Trade Organization, was sending out some thoughts, and he said, rightfully so, that if anything, this pandemic brings to light that it's not a failure of multilateralism, but an over-dependence on individual institutions. So what we know for certain is that at this point, more than ever, we need cooperation. We need multilateralism. We need to be reaching outwards, cooperating with, you know, with the science, to the latest science, to deal with this pandemic, to come up with the most effective vaccine that's cost effective too. If you look at studies that were put forward, most of the vaccines and medicines that will be hopefully predicted to be produced for COVID will be the cheapest in India, and no surprise, will be the most expensive in America. It's a fascinating table that has been, you know, put forward by a data journalist. So it's not to say that everything is doom and gloom here, but what can people do on an individual level? I guess understanding what is the value of a life. I hear a lot of people talk about, you know, in the beginning when they said herd mentality, or, you know, you hear certain news pundits talk about, oh, let's not forget how many lives we lost during, you know, World War. You know, we have to send out people. We have to start the economy. You know, it's okay if we lose some people. This is war after all. But which people? Like, whose life are you willing to sacrifice? Like, you know, are you willing, are you willing to sacrifice your life? Are you willing to sacrifice your family's life? Like, whose life? So I think the fundamental question everyone needs to ask is, what is the value of every single person's life? And are we valuing every life equally? Because the truth is, we're not. And when we ask that question to ourselves, to our community, to our state and national government, I think that's when we ourselves can get the answers to what are the solutions to ensuring people live better quality lives, to ensuring, you know, people live in a space that celebrates the idea of quality education, quality healthcare, resilient infrastructure. We're hearing these things pop up now more than ever in response to COVID, you know, the new normal. The truth is, the old normal wasn't great for very many people, you know. So when we talk about words like normal, we have to understand from whose perspective and whose life are we valuing. So from an individual sense, what I at least am trying to get myself to do is recognize what I can do in my individual capacity to in terms of proposing solutions, and who is that solution going to be affecting the most, as well as how can I use my platform to continue to push for policies, to advocate with my government as a state and national level to ensure we don't leave any more people behind.
So as you've just mentioned it, the Paris Peace Forum, where you are the president of the steering committee and of which the Körber Stiftung is a founding member, I wonder, your view on it, on the forum's mission and how it contributes improving society.
I look at forums events as what is the impact of the event going to have at the end of it, right? So post the three days, 2 days of the forum, what is the impact that the conversations there or the activity they're going to have on the very real world outside the sanitized walls of the Grand Hall de la Villette, you know, the magnificent space that we host the forum at, the impact on people's day-to-day lives, the impact on rural communities, you know, in my country, in the Caribbean, what is the impact it's going to have on the indigenous community who are worried about how the climate crisis is going to hit them. For me, the legacy of the Paris Peace Forum and the true backbone are the solutions. So Nora from Koba Shifting had actually asked this question to President Macron as to what does he envision the long-term plan for Paris Peace Forum to be? And he's betting on the solutions to be the long-term you know, vision. That's what gets me excited to work, because at the end of the day, I adore the team of the PPF Secretariat and all the institutional founders that we've work with, but I'm a, you know, on-ground activist. To me, I have to go back and answer to my community and tell them that, oh, this work that I'm doing, this is how it affects your day-to-day life. The fact that we are a solutions-driven and centered forum, the fact that specifically this year, Paris Peace Forum will perhaps be one of the first big forums that happens after hopefully things settle down a bit. No one really knows, but we're still slated to go ahead and hold that. We're already thinking of a hybrid sort of model, whether we'll attend in person, whoever can attend digitally. We've already changed our call for solutions to be responsive for the COVID crisis. We're focusing extensively on good health, the climate crisis, data protection, governance of oceans, gender equality being another huge tenet of the work that we're trying to focus on. So for me, with under Paris Peace Forum, I think being very deliberate in terms of fishing for solutions from marginalized communities, fishing for solutions that address Global South concerns. And also, this one is something I feel very passionate about. I guess it makes sense given everything else I've said before. Being very deliberate about understanding that not only is economic activity and physical activity under suspension due to COVID, but so is human rights. We have seen a complete attack on human rights during this time, not just in India, but very many countries where democracy is in crisis, or even, you know, techno-autocratic countries. And we will see this, unfortunately, as a trend unfolding. Civil society organizations that work on human rights are already feeling the weight of having to be softer, having to be quiet, deal with lack of funding, funding resources being cut, more threats, more concerns of, you know, being arrested ad hoc, being put in confinement. So I think it would be prudent as a platform that is Paris Peace Forum to also highlight and further double down on protecting human rights and civil society organizations working on the front lines to address our problems.
And that's something I wonder, because you've been in contact with so many world leaders and with so many inspiring people. So I wonder, what's the greatest advice you've ever been given?
The greatest advice? I wouldn't call it advice. This is actually related to Paris Peace Forum. The first time I heard, these are words that just forever haunted me and stuck with me and kind of have pushed, shaped my thinking. I first heard Nadia Murad, who is now a dear friend, last year's Nobel Peace Laureate, speak at a platform where she said, hope is dangerous. Hope has a time limit. Hope has an expiration date. Hope requires action. And I came from the Obama school of thought of, you know, hope.
Yeah.
And she forever bastardized the word hope for me. I can never really throw the word hope around without follow-up. But what happened at Paris Peace Forum is she was part of a panel that was talking about, does the UN Security Council need a sort of reboot? Does it need to be relooked at in terms of addressing conflict and global crisis issues? And one of the panelists seemingly looked at Nadia and said, you know, listen, we may not have prevented genocide of your people, but don't forget how many genocides we have prevented. You can look at the glass as half full or the glass as half empty. And you can imagine, of course, no one likes to hear that. That was received with a lot of pushback. The beautiful thing of Paris Peace Forum is it provides a kind of platform for people to have open conversations with the people on the dais. And after that, Nadia came to me and Nadia said, you know, She looked at me, the other panelist, later was trying to diffuse the situation with Nadia and told her, listen, Nadia, I did not mean that towards you. I meant that to someone else. And Nadia is very non-confrontational, but she came to me and she's like, I don't think that lady realizes if she's saying it to someone else, she might as well be saying it to me.
Fair point.
That to me has always stuck with me of, you know, the resilience the people show after being subject to the worst of humanity, but still show up in service to do the best they can with a sense of duty, service and urgency. Being unapologetic in demanding for better. And also in terms of a world leader, this is what I have to say. President Macron, you know, I said the good thing about the climate, you know, the good thing is, well, you know, political will is a renewable resource. It's not something you can particularly get away by saying stuff like that around world leaders. But President Macron is someone, you know, in conversations has always stood by feminists, stood by human rights defenders, and doubled down his commitment to put pressure on world leaders. For example, when he's been lobbying to, you know, free Lu Zhen, the Saudi Arabian feminist activist. So I think from a world leader, that's what you expect. Someone who will challenge his fellow world leaders to do better, who has emphatically said nationalism is a betrayal of patriotism. His words are something I hold so dear. And when a world leader like that comes to a, you know, uses his platform to say nationalism is a betrayal of patriotism and condemns violence against activists like myself, it goes such a long way in boosting morale, in making us feel like the fight is worth the fight, that there will be some sort of outcome. So yes, I guess that's the way of ensuring people live better lives.
Yeah, that's a very great perspective on life and hope as well. But there's one more thing I would like to address, because it just came out in Germany. You surely haven't heard of it, but because it's related to your topics, there are two famous German presenters who've just released a 15-minute video on how women are treated by men in Germany. So women had a voice of openly speaking in front of the camera, and everybody who sees it, it's going viral in German platforms, and everybody says it's so shocking where we are today. And I wonder what you think, if it's been something we've been hiding. Are we not speaking enough about situations that we should speak about? What do you think as an activist, and especially as a gender activist?
I think we're not being heard enough. I think people always are speaking. You know, Arundhati Roy said there's no such thing as the voiceless. It's only the actively suppressed and the deliberately ignored. And I may be paraphrasing, but it's something along those lines. But my point is, it's a system that fails to hear gender-based concerns. You know, everyone wants to talk about gender equality, but the second you start breaking down the inequality, the violence, especially the intimate partner violence, violence going on within one's homes, with one's partners, it makes people uncomfortable. They don't want to hear about it. They don't want to talk about it. Right now, we're seeing a huge spike in domestic violence cases happening globally, you know, due to the forced lockdown. And people are posing questions as, you know, oh, is it because people are within the same confinement that there's uptake in violence? No. It's just that now there's a magnified lens on all the issues that were very much prevailing everywhere. You know, it's just that now we are seeing it with a more of a magnified lens. And if anything, we should use this as an opportunity to be louder, to make more noise about it, and to ask, how can we end this cycle of violence, of discrimination, of abuse? Because the truth is, we all have a role to play. You're either perpetuating it by being complicit through your silence, through your actions, or you're actively working to end the cycle. And it takes action. It takes deliberate intention. These things, oppression doesn't happen accidentally. If you look at most human rights violations, abuses, gender-based violence, there's money and incentive behind this oppression. So none of this oppression happens accidentally. Therefore, when you're trying to put an end to years and decades of oppression, it has to be intentional. From policy level to leaders doubling down to representation, I think the COVID crisis has definitely once again brought to light that when women have leadership positions, they are addressing pandemics way better than their male counterparts. Germany has been lucky to have, you know, Chancellor Merkel's you know, strong leadership, but this is where again we have to be so intentional in how we come out of this crisis. When we talk about the economy failing, the World Bank says that women invest 90% of their earnings savings back into the economy. And the findings are, you know, fantastic. The most amount of money that they invest in is in food, healthcare, home improvement, and education. All things that we're talking about that we need to double down on to live in a post-COVID world. Men invest upwards of, I think, less than 30% back into the economy. So it really doesn't take a scientist at this point to figure out what's wrong. No. We just have to be intentional in how we move forward, because it is a make or break time for everyone.
In 2015, so it's been 5 years, you founded She Says, where you've been working for women's rights and gender equality. And we've spoken about some of the issues that we have today, but there are so many issues and topics we never think about. And you look into very different topics like digital literacy, security, advocacy and partnerships and all of that. So what is something that you would highlight? What topic of your work of She Says is something we probably, you know, haven't heard so far, or something that we haven't at front mind at the moment? Anything particularly that comes to your mind with your work?
The Greta Thunberg effect. Everyone's, you know, concerned about the climate crisis. The two most cost-effective solutions to address the climate crisis is investing in young girls' education and sexual and reproductive healthcare rights.
Right.
Because obviously, the more a girl studies, the later she will get married, the more education and access to sexual and reproductive healthcare rights she has, the more agency over her body she gets to govern and decide for herself how many kids she wants to have. And those are the most cost-effective solutions. Thank you for highlighting all the other work, because it's possible to address gender-based violence without also addressing alleviation of poverty, without addressing need for quality education, without addressing sanitation. You know, most girls, a lot of girls drop out of school due to lack of sanitation.
Right.
When young girls in India get their period, it's the second largest cause for young girls to drop out of school after forced labor. We see a loss in educational participation. Of course, it leads to a loss in economic participation. Of course, then it leads to a loss in self-agency. So it's a vicious circle that carries on. What I would want to highlight simply is gender rights affect everyone. You want to address the climate crisis, start with gender. You want to address poverty, start with gender. You want good leadership, start and end with gender. So I always look at gender as the wheel that keeps all the other spheres fluidly moving and kind of will hopefully reestablish much needed balance. So if you're looking for solutions, figure out how your solutions are gender sensitive and gender centric, and bring some women to the table and ask them, and they will have the solutions for it. So I guess that's where I would want to leave. That's pretty much the ethos of the work that we do. We're an unapologetic feminist youth-led platform where we do on-ground work, to the point of rudimentary on-ground work, where we come with survivors, where we go with survivors to police stations, hospitals, courtrooms, and help them file cases if they've been raped, get access to justice. And that on-ground rudimentary work pretty much helps us shape what policies we need to push an advocate for on a national and international level. So that's the work that we do. That's how we manage to have the kind of impact in numbers and, you know, in people's lives that we have. That's also the agenda I always push for. It doesn't matter what issue you're working on, just make sure you're accounting for it to be gender sensitive and youth centric, and you will make sure it's sustainable and improve the lives of the community and country.
So as my last question, I give you the option. You can choose between sitting on a table with someone that you really would love to discuss these topics. Who would that be? And what would you discuss? Or someone, maybe someone who's dead already, or you've never met before, but you feel so inspirational. You can choose to collaborate with in a project, in a future project. Who would that be, and what would you do?
I mean, this is easy. I would love to just sit and pick the brains of people. I'm a huge nerd who's like who asks people. I've been endlessly inspired by questions. It would be Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. I would love to sit and just, oh my God, the amount of questions I cannot even, but just take out my notebook.
Just
take out my notebook and just write endless notes on resilience and how she's been fighting for gender rights and human rights at the highest of office. It would be her, Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg.
You've got a lot of time at hand, being 30-year-old, to actually meet all the people you'd love to meet and ask all the questions that you want to ask. I'm really inspired by all your work and the energy you've been given to me today and even in all your activities. We're looking much forward to see you at the Paris Peace Forum. Thank you very, very much for having this conversation
thank
with me, Tricia Shetty.
Thank you for having me, and thank you for being an organization that's values-led. Truly, thank you for having me.
You're welcome.